Welcome to Space 19. Damn it.
Okay. No, sorry, I cleared my...
How many times did I do that?
I could have hit my mute button. I didn't. I just cleared my throat when you started your intro. That's all.
No, I said welcome to... I said the wrong thing.
Oh, okay. So,
welcome to Podcast 1999, the podcast about Space 1999. I'm your host, Mark.
These are
my co-hosts.
This is Brian.
Ah, we beat you.
That's right. That's right.
We just verbally cucked you.
Yeah. Speaking of cucking, this week's... Oh, well, so much for that.
Break the spell immediately. There we go.
It's a moment of humanity. The moment of humanity you get after you cuck a man and get punched by him and die.
What's better? What's longer, a moment or a second? The original title is 1 second of humanity. Is a moment more time or less time?
I think more, right?
I don't know.
Moment is always a very vague term.
Yeah.
It takes longer to say the word moment than a second, right?
Moment, second. Yeah, I think it's how long it takes you to say the word is how long the length of time is.
Eternity. Wow, that was fast.
That'll be you doing your trivia then, right? Compared to the moment and seconds we were just talking about, like five eternities of trivia.
I'm going to take a moment to do trivia. See how long that is? This is how long a moment is. This episode is third in production order for the second season, but it aired fourth in the UK and much later in the US run. Charles Crichton is back to direct for his second of six this season. We've got a new writer in Tony Barwick, born in 1934 in London. He wrote a lot of episodes for a relatively small number of series, including 18 of Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, 17 for Joe 90, and 12 for UFO, all of those made by the Andersons. This is one of only two credits he has in Space 1999, however. He passed away in 1993, and his final credits were 34 episodes of Dick Spanner PI. That's about a robot detective. Dick Spanner. Anyway, this episode has the final mention of the character of Dr. Mathias in the series and the final appearance of Zianni Merton for now. She quit because she wasn't given a contract and didn't feel like her pay or screen time had been adequate under Fred Freiberger's leadership. When the press asked Freiberger about her absence, he replied that they lent her out, quote unquote, to other productions, which was not possible because she was not under contract. Merton does return after a few months, but we will meet her temporary replacement next week. Lionel Blair, the choreographer of the dance scene at the end of the episode, requested that it be accompanied by Gino Vannelli's Storm at Sunup. Derek Wadsworth produced an elaborate instrumental cover of the song, which took so much effort that the music composed for a previous episode of The Exiles had to be reused to fill in the gaps, as well as some bits from season one, which this is only one of two episodes in season two that used season one music. Guesting as Zamara, we have Billy Whitelaw, born in 1932 in Coventry, Warwickshire, England. She made her debut on stage in 1950 in film 1953. She has a number of credits, including I Like Money, I Promise to Pay, and You're a Long Time Dead. But more importantly, we have another connection with The Omen, with her playing Mrs. Blaylock. And also, she voiced Augur in The Dark Crystal, and although she passed away in 2014, her final credit was in one of my favorite modern comedies, Hot Fuzz, as Joyce Cooper in 2007. Lee Lawson is our other main Vegan. Not vegan, that's different. Zarl. He was born in 1945 in Atherston, Warwickshire, England. That's also Warwickshire. How about that? Wonder if they knew each other. I guess they knew each other in this episode. And he's been married to Twiggy since 1988. Yes, that Twiggy. You can see him in Out of Depth, It's Not the Size That Counts, Sword of the Valiant, and An Unsuitable Job for a Woman. As number eight, who is not a number but a free man, we have Jeff. I can't even not laugh at that. Jeffrey Baildon, born in Leeds, England, 1924. He trained at Old Vic Theatre School and had a long and prestigious career on stage, but also over 200 on-screen credits with roles in such works as The Case of the Frightened Lady, The Amorous Mr. Prawn, and The Magnificent Magnificent Seven Deadly Sins. And you can also catch him starring as Q in Casino Royale. You can guess which one. He was working up until 2010 and passed away in 2017 at the age of 93. And that's the end of the trivia.
End of your crap trivia. Yep. Delivered by an idiot.
A moment. I'll teach you, idiot. I'll teach you violence.
I'll kill you.
He should spit some food in his face, quick.
Over Zoom.
Yeah.
I don't like that you already fixed the pronunciation, because I was fully prepared to call them vegans through the entire podcast.
I mean, don't let me stop you.
They have vegan powers, right?
They probably don't eat
meat.
Didn't
they have the same problem in Contact, right? Because the message in Contact came from the star Vega. So were they referring to them as vegans?
Yeah.
I honestly thought that we might have had something called vegans in Space 1999 already and couldn't find anything about it. I was like, this seems so familiar. It's just they're running out of sciencey words to name
it. One of the top five sci-fi names. Come on, you can create an alien race name right now.
Sigmas. I'm just going to use Greek letters.
Just used another Greek letter. Okay.
Omegas.
You're still doing it. You're still doing it.
Dolbinians.
Ooh, there we go.
I'm looking at my Thomas Dolby poster, so I thought Dolbinians.
That's the way to come up with alien names, isn't it?
Name of coming up with alien names. Yeah.
Oh, you know what? The best thing to do to name aliens in like the modern era is just go to Amazon.com and I'll search for lamp, and I'll see. Let's see some of the brand names. Adlon, Sunmori. Edishine. Well, there's some real words here. Quimic.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Runtop.
Runtop doesn't sound like an alien.
Boskios.
That does. Okay. Boskians. Got that.
Jufo.
Now you're just doing that thing where you're just making sounds again, basically. While Mark's doing that, Brian, I guess you can start your summary and he can just do that in the background.
I thought he was just going to switch to the IKEA page and just go down that, and that would keep you busy for a while.
Glorborks.
Star Trek certainly used that.
Where am I? Oh, yes. While playing dress-up and failing the Bechdel test, Helena and Maya respond to a red alert and rush to Command Center. Moonbase Alpha is losing power, and in a moment, everyone freezes in awkward poses before a strange alien woman appears who examines everyone in the room but seems very interested in Tony and Helena. When everyone snaps out of it, she introduces herself as Zamara and insists that Tony and Helena return to her planet Vega, else the base will lose all life support. They click their heels together three times and they arrive in a Playboy grotto in the middle of an icy wasteland. Other scantily clad Vegans, including Zamara's male sidekick, Zarl, and gray-dressed numbered automatons gather around them. One of these numbers warns Helena not to react with violence to the ensuing bad dinner and an insult fest perpetrated on them. Later, she and Tony sneak down to the servants' catacombs and discover that, plot twist, the numbers are the actual human beings, and the Vegans are the androids. The Vegans only learn emotion by example, and they want to pick up some pointers about hate, violence, and murder from the Alphans so they can rid themselves of the numbers once and for all. Tony and Helena seek out the central computer, but attempts to breach its defenses fail. When caught, they ask if they can just go home, and Zamara tells them to click their heels again, and sure enough, they end up back on Alpha, which is now deserted. But it's all an elaborate ruse to get the two Alphans to distrust and kill each other. Zamara returns to the real Alpha, and after consulting their public domain library, figures out that Shakespeare's Othello is just the scenario that will get Koenig to lose his cool once Zarl hits Helena with his sexy choreography. And it actually works, but Maya realizes the Vegans are all interconnected, and Helena sees that Zarl is really falling for her, so when commanded by Zamara to kill her, Zarl breaks down, and the rest of the androids are rendered inert. But as he dies, Zarl states that his one moment of humanity was worth it. A despondent Helena freezes once more, because it's time for the credits. The end.
Here's my recasting for this episode. Just for this episode, there is no Koenig gets Landau's out. We take in Jason Clark. We beam him from now. Jason Clark gets to be Koenig for this episode because he's king of the cucks.
Okay.
Like half the movies he's in, this happens, right? So he belongs here. And then if they really wanted the insults to work, they needed Rowan Atkinson. Doing his Blackadder stuff. Yeah, that would have been great.
Yeah, that would work.
That would have pissed him
off.
Well,
he is king of the insults, yes.
Yes. But no, that's neither here nor there, I guess. What else do I like? It's my dream to live in a tropical dome in the middle of a icy wasteland, like that Beach Boys album cover. The album's terrible, but the cover's good. Well, like, no, the cover's
Death
not good.
Dominion?
It's fun. Huh? Like they had to live in ice caves. That sucked.
Guess what? They reused shots from in this.
That's not unsurprising.
That's the rest of your trivia.
Okay, there we go. No, they had to live in ice caves. These guys get to live in like a tropical wonderland that's in the middle of like, you know, Antarctica or whatever. I like that.
You mean Ultima Thule is just down the street from the grotto?
Probably on the other side of the planet, yeah. Yeah, the Thulians, the humans, I guess they were humans, would be, how bummed out would you be if you were living in a cold ice cave for 900 years and realized there was a tropical dome on the other side of the planet?
I've got a question for you. If you took the Thulians specifically, you know, our two leads from that episode, and told them that they're going to be cucked by robots and they have to not punch them, how long do you think they would last?
What, John Shrapnel?
Yeah, how long do you think you'd last?
Well, John Shrapnel would drive the aliens would learn how to be insane.
Yeah.
That would teach the Vegans how to be nuts.
Of Captain Tanner's. Ah.
There is something really compelling here, but I feel like it is just not formed entirely. Like I guess there are robots who need like some information to break one of the laws of robotics. It's almost like RoboCop needing the permission to throw Dick Jones out of the window.
Yeah.
But that just comes by example, right? I mean, this civilization apparently never had like motion pictures. They never saw like Rocky or anything just on a screen and said, oh, that's how you punch someone, you know, and then story over.
It doesn't make any sense that robots wouldn't know how to do violence, because violence is the dumbest, simplest thing imaginable. We've already learned that in 2001, A Space Odyssey. It's kind of okay. Maybe you need a black rectangle to teach you how to do it if you're a monkey. But, you know, if you can build a person, you probably could break something, because how can you build without violence? You can't. You have to drill holes, right?
Like, is this an earlier version of the machines taking over? I mean, the original Star Trek must have done that at some point. I can't remember. No. But well, no, that, no, is... Star Trek doesn't have so many robots. Just Data and the Corby's robots, right?
What was that episode? Little girl, not something, Corby. Something.
Yeah, where little girls made of.
Yeah, that was before this. That was way before this.
Yeah. But I'm just trying to track, like, because
and also arguably much more complex than this.
Yeah, I'm just trying to track like how primordial we're looking at, you know, because now we use the Matrix, Skynet, it's where sci-fi is just like drowning in this stuff. But in 1976, was this a little more original at the time?
I don't feel like this was an attempt to be original. I feel like this was an attempt to be subversive, and it kind of works. Like it feels the whole thing where the robots are, oh no, the robots are people and the people are the robots. That's like that's a bold-faced attempt to be like, whoa, I blew your mind.
You know what
you
this means?
That these were robots.
The only human robot I think we saw was the Guardian, the servant of the Guardian, Catherine Schell. That's the only one I can think of in this series prior to this.
Yeah, that's a, you know, regular humanoid robot. This is an attempt to do something where it's an interest, the idea of robots. You know, what we would call approaching the singularity, even though I don't think the term singularity was coined, may have been coined like 2 years before this came out. So probably not in the heads of people writing this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm watching this and thinking like there must maybe there's like a Caligula cut of this episode that's like 3 hours long,
No.
where the Bob Guccione just inserted a bunch of random hardcore scenes in. That would kind of make sense for this episode.
Okay, 1958 was the first time that a concept that was, approaching what we think of as a singularity was discussed. So this could have been in the zeitgeist. I mean, to me, that's very interesting. And the vegans are weird, which I've said multiple times on multiple podcasts. I want my robots, my aliens to be weird because they're not human and they don't have the human experience. So they should be weird. And that's cool. However, it doesn't really make sense that they wouldn't know how to do violence, but they know how to build creatures that are real. Do you know what I mean? Like
You know
realistic.
what? When also in
That's
my
just
head with these aliens or these robots, robots is the Upright Citizen Brigade sketch where they have like an android doing like a personal video want ad. It's just like everything he's saying is like super bizarre. That's kind of the ticket of these guys, I think. I mean, they don't go for the weird as much with these because they're not making a comedy, even though some of it is kind of funny, but.
Well, yeah, it's the thing is I feel like this would work perfectly with maybe sort of a different explanation than they have to be shown violence to know how to do violence. But if they want to do violence, then it's maybe they shouldn't want to do violence. I don't entirely understand.
Yeah, they
There's
know what
sort
it
of like
is,
a
and they're violent in their minds, like we want to kill you, but we don't know how. It's like, well, you're halfway there, you want to kill someone.
Yeah,
You should be
teach
able
me
to
how to
figure it out.
kill. Yeah, it doesn't make sense that any type of intelligence would be able to build without knowing how to kill. But that's the thing is that that's what's, I mean, it is really compelling, the idea of the three laws of robotics, and somebody getting around to any of them is interesting inherently. So,
And just think how happy
but
that one robot is once he learns how to punch things.
well, yeah,
He
and
went around
then,
punching all sorts of things, didn't he? He was quite happy to punch things once he figured out the motions, I guess.
but then
Monkey see, monkey
Koenig and
do.
Helena yell at him to feel love, and then he breaks down and dies. So, which doesn't make a lot of sense either.
The planet didn't blow up, did it? So they just said it was about to.
No.
So, I mean, there are other
Well, it
people
said it
living
was
there.
booby-trapped. If you messed with the computer, the planet would blow up, but they subverted the computer from within, so the planet didn't
Yeah,
blow up.
just when you say that, I just assume Koenig's going to blow up the planet because that's what he usually does.
No, you're thinking of Janeway. No, well, at least it was still within Eagle range because I assume somebody launched an Eagle. I mean, it's funny how the episode kind of ends rather abruptly, don't you think? I mean, you usually don't get the little denouement of them, saying, well, goodbye, and we'll pile into our eagle and take off and fly away.
Well, there
Almost like.
was an epilogue. Here's more trivia. I lied. There's more. There was an epilogue recorded
Warning.
where Alan shows up with like suits to keep everybody warm, and they, I think, make some joke about dead Varl or whatever his name is. Jarl? Zarl? Is it
Yeah, there's
Zarl?
Zarl. Yeah.
Zarl. And then they freeze frame and laugh. But they had to cut that. I don't know why.
Yeah,
But yeah.
I saw that in the book. I finally it's in the second volume of the second season books, Mind Breaks of Space. So it's
Whoa,
like
that's a good
episode eight
name.
in the books. Yeah, they have all the weird, bizarre, psychologically demented aliens are in that episode. We'll come across them soon.
I say we don't get a whole lot of time on real Alpha because we spend a lot of time on fake Alpha and on Vega, but
Oh yeah.
there is a scene where Alan's like the power is or it's too cold to launch an Eagle or there's not enough power to launch. I can't remember exactly what they did to people, to everyone, to freeze them, or if it was just cold. It was
What at
kind
the
of vague.
beginning when everyone freezes and condense? No, they explained that's a like electromagnetic field they're putting around the moon
The
base.
electro field,
Yeah,
electrostatic field around you and
that's
your
probably why
base,
I
yeah.
forgot, is
Yeah.
because it was just
And
the
then it
same
gets cold
words.
because she's like, I'll leave you with some life support, but she's a poo-poo liar. They're good at lying. Maybe they're not good at
No.
killing yet, but they're good at lying.
I mean, why not just sit there and watch them almost freeze to death and unfreeze them and then watch them attack you, and then they'll teach you how to kill.
Yeah, that, really that could be easy. A good plan.
It'd been really easy. They didn't have to do all the stuff.
Again, it seemed like thinking of Blackadder, it seems like there was this, it seems like they always had a cunning plan. They have all these cunning plans to make you be violent, and you know, it's just like it seems like they overthought it a little bit. Speaking of robots in television, it occurs to me that the trope has usually been, this is a robot, but he does not know he's a robot until he's been exposed as a robot, which happened like in the Twilight Zone, like what, 3 times?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cue the episode I'm posting next week.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking of that one. I was thinking of the After Hours, which was a mannequin, not a robot, uh-huh. But still. There was another one in there between. Is it the After Hours? No, that was the
After Hours one. Was the mannequin one.
The lateness of the hour.
Lateness of the hour was the robot.
Oh yeah.
Did not know she was a robot. That seemed to be the way robots trying to become more human. Of course, we always think of Data, but I think we can go back to Data's predecessor, which was Questar. If the Questar tapes that was filmed about the same time, wasn't it 1974 or something? As a robot who was incompletely programmed, so now he, you know, wasn't it Robert Foxworthy? He had to go out and figure out how to be human in the pilot for the Questar tapes, which never became a series.
Wow. Trying to look as confused as possible. Okay.
I'm I think it's a YouTube. Because I'm very confused.
Yeah.
You never saw Questar tapes. Oh, okay.
No.
That and Genesis 2 are the main attempts at Roddenberry to come up with sci-fi series in the 70s. They're on DVD.
Yeah. All right, cool. I'm missing a lot of the back, whatever, a lot of that stuff.
Huh. I guess personal computers entering people's lives has a lot to do with it too. Because before that, you just wouldn't think about the machine, thinking. But once you start communing with it, using it, right, you start thinking a little more like, what is this thing capable of?
Well, and now we have that kind of thing where people think that ChatGPT is thinking and sentient. Like the guy who Google fired because he thought their AI was sentient, which is, by the way, wrong. It's not. Not even close.
No, you know, a year and a half ago, and I was messing around with the visual AI stuff, not ChatGPT, but I, like, you know, I found the limits of it within like 20 minutes, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not saying that, I'm not saying like poo poo AI isn't real, it doesn't do anything, but it's just this thing where it's almost like people want to be fooled.
I think the thing with using AI is you have to be discerning and, you know, pick and choose what it's doing. You know, use it as basically a spitboard for ideas, you know?
Well, yeah, that's just the fact that you're just dealing with a bunch of aggregated knowledge, and it's some kind of framework that's computing as fast as it can, and
it's computing it's as got, fast as I can.
It's just not a thinking person.
All that knowledge that it scraped from the internet was public domain knowledge, right? None of it was like, you know, proprietary.
Well, there's
copyright.
There's public, public domain knowledge, yes. No, copyrighted material. There are people who are paid to train AI, working a lot. So, yeah, there's a lot behind the curtain. It's not just magic.
Right.
The thing is, I was really, thinking this week for some reason that the whole, sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, because it only works if you completely ignore the idea of manufacturing. Oh sure, it's magic. Like if all magic, that's what's great about the series Full Metal Alchemist, is that sort of like the magic, you have to kill people to do magic, basically.
That's fine.
Anyway,
I wanted to go back three spaces. You said Alan got his scene cut at the end of this, right? Meaning
yes.
Nick Tate got his scene cut, and when he was on screen, I was like, tell me if I'm reading in too much, but I was like, that's one of the most depressing looking, not depressing looking, but he looks depressed on screen.
I think he and Lando both look very depressed this season so far, but especially him.
Yeah, yeah. It was almost like a black hole of charisma, which is weird because he's very charismatic in season one, right?
It's a bummer. Yeah, I think he's, I feel like I maybe was too hard on Tony last week. He did a good job with this. Even though
a few more weeks,
it's just weird how they keep putting him and Helena together.
Yeah, I was going to say they should
say it's like they always pair up those two for some reason. Why?
They should have t-shirts that say like hostages on them or something. Just make it easy for everyone to call them
hostage one, hostage two.
they're in their party outfit for like more than half the episode.
Does Helena ever get out of it? I think she's in it the entire time.
She's on another whole replica Moonbase Alpha with her quarters and presumably all of her clothes, and she doesn't change.
Does not change.
She just stays in that.
She likes the dress.
And then she does the thing where she...
It's the red dress.
Talking out loud.
Becomes a problem when Requiem for a Dream, where you want to get back into your red dress. But she's living the life right now. She can wear it.
Well, you know, it's really important that we know that Alpha has parties. Like, it's a new thing. Everybody needs to know that Alpha has parties, that also that Maya and Tony want to have sex. Mm. That's very important.
Well, Solarium's always a party, right? They had that sitar concert. That was a party, right?
Yeah, I actually can't. I cannot attack this season for doing that because season one was just like, whoa, we're all naked.
Like, you see a lot of evidence that Tony and Maya were in love because it's only episode 3 and they didn't even meet in episode 1. So only had one episode in between where they hardly interacted and now they're in love. I guess we're supposed to deduce this from the prologue where she's talking about, oh, Tony likes this style of hair, blah, 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 blah. And that's supposed to be in love.
I can't. I mean, honestly, I can't really single this show out for that either because just stuff from this era. From stuff of this vintage that isn't extremely, I don't know.
Yeah, 1976, we don't have to worry about will they, won't they. It's just like, let's go.
People, it seems very common in older stuff like this for people to say, I am in love. When they like somebody, it turns into I am in love with them because that's the only acceptable type of horniness.
Do you find it uncomfortable if you're at a party or something, you're talking to someone, and then they introduce someone, this is my lover. I feel like that's uncomfortable.
I don't think that's
happened. I've heard somebody say that before. They've used that term in a public setting. And it's like, yeah, it's kind of an awkward phrase. I mean, I thought, well, I'd be more classy. Say, this is my paramour.
Ooh.
Paramour. It's like Game of Thrones. This is my paramour.
Well, there was a, I don't want to say it was awkward. It was just whatever. But there was a guy I worked for who introduced me to his partner. And I thought it was like his business partner. But they were also romantic partners. They were just both partners.
Mm. See, I find partner to be a little more like less, I guess lover just like, it's like they're daring you to like imagine them loving or something.
I like partner. I know a lot of people who introduce themselves as partners. I don't think I've had anybody introduce me to their lover. I don't think that's happened. But if someone did, I'd be like, okay, cool. If someone introduced me to someone they were dating and they said, we're in love, I would immediately try to distance myself from them.
Mm. I thought you were going to argue the statement. You think you're in love, but
what? Yeah, love is an illusion, man. No, I've been around long enough. It's usually people who talk the loudest about being in love are the ones who are hitting each other.
Mm.
Take that to the bank, everyone listening.
Oh, dear.
Not these robots, though. Not these robots.
Not these robots. Oh, yeah. There's nothing wrong with wanting to hit. Yeah. It's like imagine if somebody's like, this is my lover. I would like you to teach me how to hit them. I want to hit them, but now I just feel like I'm giving people a bunch of audio to isolate.
Yeah, yeah.
What are you trying to tell us, Mark? What are you
I just teach me how to hit, okay? I'm not gonna say anymore.
If I want to play golf, I don't really know how to play golf. I mean, I see how it's done, but if I just went to a golf range right now and tried to, you know, without any instruction, just, you know, try and drive it, it's probably not going to go well.
Well, you have to get a robot to teach you at Top Golf. You have to go to Top Golf, and the robot tells you how to play golf.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, it seems obvious that the Vegans should just be able to do violence, right? But
that is the central problem with this episode. That is 100%.
That's what I'm saying. It seems like obvious. I should just be able to go out, pick up a golf club, and you know, do it, right? But I can't. I would need instruction. I need to see how it's done properly.
Really, like if I said you have 24 hours on this golf course. Okay, you don't want to spend 24 hours on a golf course. You have 12 hours on this golf course. Here's three meals. Here's a place to take a nap if you need to take a nap. You are going to take these. I'll give you 1,000 golf balls so you can practice as much as you want. You'd figure out how to play golf in a day.
But not well. Like, okay, that's okay.
Maybe, yeah, I guess maybe you would. I don't know.
They could hit badly. Maybe they want to do the perfection of violence. Violence isn't good enough. They have to do it in a perfect way.
Well, they.
I'm sorry. I have to watch Tiger Woods play golf in order to figure out how to play golf. It's got to be done that way.
They were, you know, what they were trying to do was like, you need to help me remove this regulator on my behavior, but they just didn't explain it really.
I mean, I know I'm like, you know,
tell me.
I mean, I know I'm devil advocating what you're saying here, but I should also point out that right in the middle of my notes, I have written, that twist was stupid? ? So, you know, it's not like I'm not agreeing. I just feel like I'm trying to, you know, work out if through the filter of a weird AI, an alien AI, it could make more sense.
I think the twist where the humans were the robots and the robots were the humans was a great twist, but the twist where the robots need to learn violence, so that's why they've been being rude, is not fully formed. Not great.
Okay.
Also, that is, I know this predates it, but it kind of got the really heavy black hole vibes from this, because, you know, all the automatons on the Cygnus were actually the humans. Spoiler alert from Black Hole.
Yeah, I need to rewatch it.
But this predated that.
That's what the other thing that I was thinking. I need to rewatch it. And then you rewatch it and you're like, maybe I didn't need to rewatch it. Sorry, Brian, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say the whole, you know, you're on a complete copy of the place where you live in order to drive you mad sort of thing. It goes straight back to, what was it, Missing Link. So Koenig did this already last season.
True.
But got the real strong Mark of Gideon vibes from the people peering out of the walls like, oh, hi, surprise, I was watching.
I like that. I did like this abandoned alpha segment a lot better, though. Also because they're like playing the mind games of trying to get Helena and Tony to laser each other, right? So
yeah, I had to watch that scene more closely to see, did Tony actually have an opportunity where he was able to put pills in her drink? And apparently he did. He was behind her sitting down, then he got up again. So it really did look like he did it. I mean,
that also felt like it wasn't formed all the way. Like it
yeah.
There was something interesting there. Like that almost could have been the entire episode. But it also resolved really quickly, and then they were laughing. Yeah. And I was like, were they laughing because they knew what they were doing the whole time? And I wasn't even entirely clear on that.
I think the laughing was just an attempt to cover up whatever frustration or ever, and to, you know, just basically ridicule them for failing.
They were about to hook up and they wanted to play it off really quick in case Conan was watching.
So,
because I gotta say, man, I hate to say it, Helena and Tony have pretty good chemistry. Like they actually have better, I don't know, better chemistry than Maya and Tony for some reason. And it's just because they keep bearing them off, probably.
What about Koenig also, and Maya? What about their chemistry?
I think that's
Koenig's doing a lot of touchy feeling with Maya now, you notice.
Yeah,
he's always like patting her on the back, and it's like, oh, what's going on here? What's going on with Maya?
Well, you know what that would be like? It would be amazing. He would be like, turn into a gorilla, and then that he would have the gorilla like fight the gorilla, and then when they were done fighting, then they'd be like, turn into Helena now. No,
man. I did that last week.
They already did that.
I'm so internet poisoned that I cannot think of people being normal with powers. It's just impossible.
Hey, they could be into a whole bunch of, you know, we don't see Moonbase After Dark, so.
Like turn into Balor, and then he's gonna fight.
Could have been like, I mean, maybe the alien, the Vegan stuff was like too chill for them. They're up to much weirder stuff, you know, on the moon base.
Was anybody else kind of distracted by how much, I keep forgetting their names because they never said their names. Zamara, how much Zamara looks like Barbara Bain? Like they look really similar to me. Am I crazy?
I just
other than being blonde, I didn't think she
obviously they're wearing way different outfits, so it wasn't like I was going to get them straight up confused. But for a second, I was like, "Are they doing another clone thing here?"
I thought you were going to tell me it's that same wig from season one that's on her head now. It never left.
I did another one of those things where I watched things in too close proximity, and I was like, "Oh yeah, she looks exactly like her." But that was actually because I was watching a Mission Impossible episode with a younger thing.
Oh, okay, of course.
So in the space episode, no, because I was about to like emphatically agree, and I was like, wait, nope, that was a completely different show.
Well, speaking of casting, I was thinking that, you know, Castor and Zorro from last week would have fit in better as young, youthful specimens of health amongst all these other vegans, other than Billy Whitelaw, who was like already in her 40s, I guess. Actually, things that she's been in after this, she looks younger than she looks in this episode. She frankly looks kind of old.
I don't think it's flattering makeup, outfit, etc. But
well, my note when she first shows up is she probably came in from the Ren Fair, so I guess that's the that was the temperature I took.
I wonder if it was like, well, we cast some younger people last week and it worked very badly, so we're going to go back to casting mature people. Well, I guess what's his name? Zarl.
I think pretty young. Think Carl, Zarl, but with a Z. Zarl
Marx.
That does not roll off the tongue. That, in fact, you almost choke yourself like saying that name.
Yeah, so he was like 30, so that's pretty young for this, 30 something.
Yeah, I do wonder if that's like maybe a Friedberger cost saving measure is, you know, hire younger, cheaper people.
Oh, of course. I mean, it makes perfect sense. I'm not even going to suggest that it was a great idea to always hire super top shelf actors for the first season, because they weren't always saving the episodes they were in, right?
For the most part, they kind of did. A few of them.
I'm thinking about the perspective of the androids themselves is like they want to be perfect humans. So why did they, who do they model Zamara after? You know, it's like, does it have to be one older leader of the androids, you know, and they signal that by casting an older person or having the android be an older person? I don't know. I guess I'm thinking of the Cylons from Battlestar Galactica. They got, you know, like, who was the leader? Number one. Dean Stockwell.
Dean Stockwell.
Yeah, so he's like the senior most Cylon.
He's
got the gravitas there.
But at some point, he starts complaining about the fact that he's the one stuck in like an old man body. That might have been one of the movies I think it might have been the one where like you see what he's doing the whole time in the first two seasons. They did a movie on that. I think he's like complaining about being stuck in the old man robot body, whereas everyone else gets young and pretty ones.
Well, so I suppose those Cylons came to this planet to see the Vegans, and they're telling the Vegans, no, don't bother. Being human is all it's cracked up to be. Just don't even bother. Just go back to enjoying your parrots.
Yeah, that maybe they could have skipped the whole part where Helena and Tony were trapped to the fake alpha in favor of more Vegans being weird. And that would have maybe suited this episode. I'm going to say, all things considered, I do really like this episode, especially the music.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you blew me away with that trivia about the music. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Gina Minnelli had anything to do with this episode.
I usually do not look anything up until after I've watched the episode. While that was happening, while I was watching it, I was just like, what is happening with this?
Oh, and the album cover, of course, you're making me stare at that before we hit record.
You should make that his
big hairy chest. Picture. Yeah, that was
great. But Mark pointed out that he seems to have boobs under the hairy chest.
It's just like
moobs. Part of his moobs.
Moobs. No, it's just part of his six pack that's exposed to evoke the idea of boobs. Yeah. But yeah, that's
and then there's some bored lady in the background.
It was
I've listened to this score a lot of times over the years, and I just thought, oh well, this is just Derek Wadsworth being jazzy and crazy, and found out, oh no, he's just basically aping this Gino Vannelli song. It sounds almost, but not quite exactly like It's like just wondering if someone about the copyrights and everything, the implications of it.
Yeah, it from all I could see is authorized, which is probably cheaper than using, definitely cheaper than using the actual music. It's like, I don't know how I would feel if I was scoring a film and someone was like, hey, copy this. Like, would I be mad? I feel like I would just tell them, hell no, I will not do that. But at the same time, it's so cool that I'd be like,
well, I understand that's a problem with modern directors. I mean, it kind of goes all the way back to Kubrick, right? And his score for 2001 is like, they fall in love with their temp tracks. And then mm-hmm. they tell the composer, can you write something that sounds like this? And so you end up with Ghostbusters, which sounds like I want a new drug,
which
you
is
know,
literally...
and things like that. Yeah. So that's why this intrigued me. It was like, how did they mm-hmm. make this happen? I mean, I always think of the Glee debacle. You remember what happened with Glee and Jonathan Coulton's cover of Baby Got Back?
I do not remember that.
But no, so you go on.
Oh, good. Baby Got Back was covered by Jonathan Coulton, and his arrangement is, you know, completely opposite of the rap song, and it's hilarious mm-hmm. for that reason. But it sounded like the people at Glee wanted to put this song in their episode, so they consulted who did Baby Got Back? I'm sorry,
Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Sir Mix-a-Lot. Thank you. They you know, they got permission from Sir Mix-a-Lot to use it, but then they used Colton's arrangement. In fact, some people think they actually got a hold of his actual, you know, instrumental tracks because they were available for download at one point, and just put their actors, their voice actors, their singers on that track and put it in an episode. And the internet went wild. It's like, wow, no credit for Jonathan Colton's arrangement of this version of Baby Got Back. And it turned out that legally they didn't have to credit him. And Colton kind of decided not to make a fuss about it. He says, I'm not going to die on that hill. It's just, you know, they got away with it. But I think a lot of people went out and bought a lot of Jonathan Coulton albums after that in support of him, just to make up for the fact that he got national exposure, but no credit for it. And so that reminded me again, this is the situation. So.
Yeah. And I made several music notes before we got to that part of the episode too. There's some Perfect Driver's mm-hmm. Ed music in there. I like that. You know, industrial film music from the 70s. I'm notorious for digging mm-hmm. that stuff.
Well, I'm at the point where I'm just unabashedly going to say that I like Derek Wadsworth's music better. it's not necessarily appropriate every time, but I love it very much.
Well, it's more modern. It's more kind of dynamic, I guess, in some respects. I still like Derek Perry a lot, but yeah,
I love it. No, yeah, don't get me wrong. I love it, but this is more... This
Barry
is just
Gray's music,
wheelhouse.
It's more like, you know, slow moving amorphous blobs in space, right? That's mm-hmm. what Barry yeah. Gray soundtracks. But when we're having, you know, like disco setups, you know, obviously the season two music's a fit. So, hey, the music fits each season pretty well, I'd say.
And yeah, also the fact that they only record like 5 episodes worth of music and then just rerun it for the remaining 20 episodes.
Yeah, I guess we might be tired of it in about 10
well,
episodes.
And then the big chunk of this episode being that music that was Gino Vannelli. You're probably going to hear a lot of it.
That's very interesting. So, wow, we hear this again? We hear that again? Wow, that's amazing.
Probably
again,
will.
I was watching some Mission Impossibles, and it does start to drag. It's like, oh, there's that theme again. Not the main theme, the things are happening theme that sounds kind of like Klingon music.
Well, the big one for me is the Venture Brothers, because when that came out, it was a huge deal that J.G. Thirlwell was doing the music for it. You know, the guy was Foetus, Foetus. And, you know, for the first season or two, it's like you would rarely hear anything repeated. And then eventually you never heard anything new and you didn't see his name associated with the show anymore. So it's like they obviously, whenever their Adult Swim was cutting the budget, they were just like, yeah, we're just going to take what we have and reuse it. So bummer on that, but oh well,
right,
that wasn't
the first season. They've done it.
That wasn't to me that wasn't the biggest problem with that show going forward. But I know I'm alone.
There are very few
that.
Shows that have like an original score all the way through. I think Babylon 5 mm-hmm. did. I think Christopher Franck did a lot of scoring for that.
I'm
show.
Sure a lot of the modern stuff does, because you know mm-hmm. it's like 10 episode season blast. You just get someone to do the music, right?
Yeah.
True.
10 episode season. Okay, I said that
well,
right.
You guys are the composers, so I defer to your wisdom and knowledge on this subject.
Oh, I mean, I quit. I retired.
He retired.
I retired.
Oh, you retired already.
I've never made any money. Yeah, so I'm retiring and I'm just going to do podcasts now. I'm a podcaster now.
He's a podcaster now.
If I'm going to not That's make any money, I'd are. Rather just sit. If I'm not going to make any money, I'm going to sit here talking, which is much more fun than fulfilling requests. But, you know, this is just the thing is that I, even though I said, wow, it would be fun to do that music, the number one thing I hate about composing anything is someone says, hey, do this, because I don't like doing that. I don't like copying things. I don't like covering. I don't like covers. Playing in a cover band to me was one of the worst, most miserable experiences. And most people don't feel like that. They're like, oh, it's so chill to be in a cover band. I'm like, no, I like writing. I like doing original things.
One of my most vivid dreams ever is I was in an arena and suddenly I was supposed to play bass for Def Leppard. And I did, like for three songs. Wow. The thing is, I don't like Def Leppard that much. So I was like, why was that my dream? I don't.
It can't be anything you really want to do. It's got to be something weird because it's a
but
dream.
It was still cool because it was like an arena and so it was still exciting and it was fun. I remember it was fun to play the Def Leppard songs, but I remember one of them in the dream was specifically Armageddon, so it was a real Def Leppard song.
it's one of those things where sure, okay, if you're offering me the job playing with Def Leppard, that would probably be fun at first, and then it would get really fun when I got good at it, and then it would get boring, and that would probably all happen with the first year.
Yeah, I think that's the I think that's a pretty normal arc for a musician that does a tour or whatever, or as a
that
hired
said,
hand.
I mean, yeah, but that said, it's like if you're making enough money that you can retire, then who cares?
Right. So I'll tell you to do something. Tell me how much of this is hard sci-fi and how much is soft sci-fi. Mm.
Oh, this is a good one for that. I'm going to say, geez, this is probably a good like 70 hard, 30 soft.
Yeah, I mean, we front loaded our conversation with a lot of, you know, like AI, you know, evolution of that stuff. So that's some hard sci-fi.
I mean, the worst thing I can say about this episode is it had a shot at being near 100% hard sci-fi and it blew it. But,
But I think I like it better that it didn't.
I did like this is probably pound for pound my favorite episode of the second season so far, except for, I mean, it would be cool if it had Brian Blessed in it or somebody on Brian Blessed's level, but you know, that's fine.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
So my sticking with the rules answer, I think I'm more like 50-50, but what I really want to go is 33 and a third hard, 33 and a third soft, and 33 and a third 70 sarfcore setups.
I was gonna say it's like 90% soft core sci-fi.
Yeah, it's Matt's 333 and a thirds are all like albums by what's his name, the guy, the Italian man, Gino Villani. They're all Gino Villani albums.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm having trouble in names this week for some reason.
But you
soft
found
sci-fi, I would have to give to their central computer, which looked like it was made from leftover parts from Puri and Psyche.
Probably was.
All the little balls were piled up around the base of the main console. I thought, I know where those came from.
Well, those are technical signifiers of this area of the galaxy, or whatever galaxy they're in at this point. I guess they don't even know where they are.
Stuff
at this
has
point.
Balls, no. Big balls everywhere. Balls, universe. Big white balls.
Yeah, AC/DC. Wait. I forgot. You said Def Leppard. That would have been made more sense if it was a Def Leppard song, but it wasn't. That was AC/DC. Never mind. Well. At least I said the name of the band right. We are coming to the end of this episode, but we haven't really talked at all about how Koenig had to watch this robot dance with Helena without punching him.
That Why did the Jason Clark thing up front, right?
My notes is like, Koenig has the willpower of a teenager, apparently.
Yeah,
because he sees his girlfriend dancing with someone and wants to go punch them. It's like, really?
It's a robot. Really? I mean, I know they're realistic and
it really
and
didn't
advanced.
Make any sense to me. I mean, that whole aspect of it, the whole romance, sexuality stuff, it just seemed very juvenile.
And like, if you hit
why
them,
why would anybody do that?
Yeah, if you hit them, they might kill all of you. In fact,
right.
I mean, they might kill all of you if you don't hit them, but they probably were going to kill all of them anyway.
Yeah, I guess it threw me off. My notes
they would have
died
of neglect.
Yeah, my notes are Koenig's got to get cucked to save the moon base or not. What's going on?
It's like, what?
He gets to have his cake and eat it too, I guess. So, yeah.
It's like Lando is making a point that he's like, whoa, angry Koenig's coming. Angry Koenig's coming. He's not, you know, he's like, he's whispering, like, oh, I don't know how much more I could take of this. Like, he wants to scream. I want to scream and punch.
This episode, because you get to see the mechanics of Koenig screaming. You don't just see Koenig screaming. You see, like, it's like a, there's like a,
you know, pressure cooker,
like, in on his face.
I put in my notes, can you really be jealous of a robot? It's like a sex toy.
Oh no, yeah, I wrote here, androids won't get you pregnant, just ask Jude Law.
Yeah, or Data has to build them. He doesn't.
Data's
again more reason for a rational base commander to not be upset by this.
He's terrible. Yeah.
Well, sorry, to be honest, unlike Koenig, I'm willing to watch this go full 70 soft core.
I mean, I would have been fine. Oh, also, we have parrots returning, including Maya's parrot once.
Yeah, that's so, also like,
that's
in my
pretty
note.
Cool.
So the new android plan is sexy. Meanwhile, Maya is now a parrot. she's definitely a bit.
I think
there's
a parrot farm near Pinewood Studios. There must be a parrot farm down the road because they keep bringing the parrots back.
Makes sense. I mean,
there's a rainforest cafe.
Yeah. I'd love it if just the guy who is the head of Pinewood is an eccentric guy who has like 50 parrots and you just loan them out to productions.
Remember the
episode from last season where the one parrot learned how to yell cut, so they had to replace it.
That's impressive. Oops. Though. He's the director now. They should have gotten him like a little director's hat.
I mean, okay, question. You give it to the parrot that can yell cut or Fred Freiberger? Do you give him Fred Freiberger's job?
With the parrot? Cut? Yeah. No, he'd cut too much stuff.
You're right, he'd cut even more people.
He'd cut the cool stuff, yeah.
Oh boy.
But yeah, it was kind of a weird thing. Like, here's a very new situation for Space 1999. It's getting saucy. But then, we were like, where is it going to go? Oh, it's going to go to the regular place where Koenig eventually does scream and punch. So,
yeah. I don't know how you would write a better ending. I guess you would.
No, they didn't. They just ended the episode, didn't they?
It's one of those
they
things
did,
where the androids learning violence was basically Chekhov's gun. Like, you knew it was going to happen.
Right,
and it
was
cool when it happened because the guy was just smashing statues and stuff. Like, whoa, you know, that's cool.
Why they wanted to learn it so bad. Yeah, so they could do that.
If they pushed over a statue by mistake and it broke, would that count as them learning violence? Did you guys know that John Wayne Gacy's first kill was basically he brought a sex worker home with him and then was just making breakfast and the guy like sort of came up behind him and John Wayne Gacy thought he was going to kill him, so he just stabbed him and then he learned that he liked killing.
Well, I guess that's what I do now.
A misunderstanding. Yeah. Like, you think that could have happened? Like, I guess that's what's happening
with the Vegans, isn't it?
I guess he probably already knew how to stab somebody.
Yeah. But he hadn't done it. The robots hadn't done it. They hadn't actually punched anybody. So,
man, this is like, do you think John Wayne Gacy saw this and he was like, I'm going to accidentally do this one?
I don't think we need to blame the producers of Space 99 for the crimes of John Wayne Gacy.
What if Alpha was full of psychopaths? How would this episode played out? I think we've already discovered that.
Yeah, I mean,
my question would Captain Kirk have been proud of the way the computer was confounded into destroying itself? Because he does it all the time with Landru. Vol.
Well, we have the relationship
Nomad.
With the wrinkle here, though, because, you know, Kirk
would have tricked somebody. That's why he's fit to be captain.
He would have tricked the robots into the Vegans into just punching something, and then their brain would have exploded because they hadn't learned how to do it first.
Yeah.
That's my
or
guess.
Maybe he would have just watched the robot have sex with Helena and been like, well, see, now you haven't learned violence, but you've learned love.
Well,
and then
Kirk
that
didn't have a steady
sweetie
on the Enterprise, though. So
true. Yeah,
that changes
exactly.
The situation.
No, if Helena was on the Enterprise, Kirk would have been like, I know not to do this.
I think Helena was sort of the Kirk in this, but inadvertently she was like, okay, because she's the one who throws herself in front of him and says, don't hurt anybody. And that's what threw him off. I said, oh, but I like you. Oh, but I have to kill you. Oh, ooh, Nomad, coordinate. Yeah, I was thinking of Larry's Muds episode, too, with
it's
all the androids.
Oh, yeah.
Zarl, coordinate. Zarl.
didn't Shatner recently come out and say that Roddenberry would be disgusted by crew members dating each other on one of the newer series?
Shatner says lots of stuff.
Well, there you go. That's proof that he would not approve of the relationship that led to the robot cucking. So,
okay.
You know. Well, I guess that's the actor and not the character, but still. Yeah, don't date your coworkers, listeners.
Command probably shouldn't date each other.
Yeah.
That's one of the things on the Orville, right? It's like, this is weird.
Yeah, that didn't really work, did it? I mean, maybe don't date like a woman who's an alien disguised as a regular lady, but I guess that was a big mistake. That's a big mix them up.
Only when she's disguised as a gorilla. That's the only time it's okay.
Yep. Yeah, but you know, you fight the gorilla and then you probably have sex with a human, even though I don't know.
We're learning Mark's weird kinks today.
I'm just projecting what I think Koenig is like. And I think that is a kinky individual.
Okay, sure. Yeah, it's just like how high-powered execs, you know, pay doms to beat them around.
Yep. yeah, indeed. Weren't there two different human carpet guys? And there was like at least one human carpet guy in New York who was just like the human carpet. He would just go to a bar and like he would be wearing like a carpet and he would just like lie down under the next to the bar and he'd be like, hey, just step on me, please. He'd go to parties and stuff. Yeah, I'm like 90% certain that someone that I know has been around that guy at some point. I don't know if they took the time to step on him or not, but
he's trying to learn the secret of being a carpet, but only by example.
Yeah, he's like, teach me how to be a carpet so I can learn. Like these robots wanted to learn violence. He wanted to learn.
He was just confused. He meant to be a carpetbagger, but he got it wrong. I don't know. Shall we wind it down then? Unless someone's got a hot take on something.
I'm going to say inappropriate
lots of,
stuff and
lots
laugh.
Of heat in this episode, but yeah. No hot takes. Just lots of jazz and
I guess this is a new height of body space 1999, because we've had a few, you know, where people running around in bath towels and stuff. So this is solariums.
There is definitely a lesson here, even though I know it was not intentional, but you meet somebody new, you kind of start a thruple, and then you're going to watch your wife dancing with another man the next week. That's going to happen. It's going to happen, and you shouldn't punch him. Because
it's amazing anyone made
it
out of the 70s with an intact relationship.
I don't know if they did. Oh, wait, your parents did. Anyway, and so did mine. But anyway. it's fun if we could just make this entire season just like craft this meta narrative of the opening up of John and Helena's relationship and all the perils of it.
Stay tuned.
I will say Barbara Bain is definitely having more fun this season so far. So
yeah,
we're Alan, well, maybe Nick Tate and Landau or not, but she is.
Yeah, she's hanging out with Tony. You get a lot of Tony time.
Tony time.
Let's see where Tony time lives.
See what happens with Tony.
We'll have more Tony time. Don't worry.
Mark's now. I'm watching the Mark Gage where he like is like winding up his motor to do the promo stuff. So
I'm too tickled by my own nonsense. But you know, if you want to be tickled by some better nonsense than mine, then you can go to patreon.com/podcastiopodcastius. There is my server bill to see outtakes. I mean, listen to outtakes, listen to other podcasts such as Pillars of Filth, the Citizen Kane to podcasts, Luclos Pokemon, Game Show, The Game Show About Games, Occult Disney, Time Enough podcast about the Twilight Zone, Hyrule Field Report. And that's all of them.
Instead of my nonsense, here's some better nonsense, but a lot of that's still your nonsense.
Okay.
So it's kind of false advertising.
Well, but it's better nonsense. I think that I've done a lot better. I think this is one of the worst podcast episodes I've ever personally recorded. I mean, one of the worst performances I have done on a podcast, because I keep just saying stuff and cracking up about how stupid, because this episode made my brain explode. I do blame the episode.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Our first casualty.
No, right before recording, I had to go back and just reread the wiki summary, because like, what was that about?
Someone is listening to this and like so mad at me and everything, and they love this episode. And they're like, what are you doing?
You've taught them how to hate. Good job, Mark.